And cancer is really, it is about life. The whole book is a book about life, but life gone terribly, terribly wrong.
Yes.
And that question about how do you unfold something from one cell, from one genome, into all the diversity, and whether that's all the diversity of life on Earth, whether it's the incredible body of a baby growing in the womb, or the horrendous process of a cancer developing, you know, that is what I find endlessly fascinating.
Kia ora and welcome to The C Word, the podcast for cancer-free people. I'm your host, Helen King. If you like what you hear today, subscribe to the show on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. Why do we get cancer? If you're like me and you've had a cancer diagnosis, this may be one of the first questions that runs through your mind when you hear those words, you have cancer. What did I do to cause this? My guest today is an award-winning science writer, broadcaster, and public speaker. She's also the host of a fantastic podcast, Genetics Unzipped. Dr. Kat Arney spent a decade in Cancer Research UK's communications team, and she became very familiar with writing What Cancer Is, a collection of cells that grows out of control. She started thinking maybe we need to stop asking what cancer is and start asking why cancer. This is the basis of her latest book, Rebel Cells, Cancer Evolution and the Science of Life. I caught up with Kat last week and I started our conversation with a quote that I love and I had seen Kat use in one of her previous talks. It's from Marie Curie. Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood. Now is the time to understand more so that we may fear less. And I love that quote because I feel like it really captures how we feel about cancer, because I feel like we really fear it. I think when you have had it, you sort of understand what a, you know, frightening experiences it is. But the guest I had last week made a really good point that the more we know and the more knowledge that we have, the less fear we can have around something. And so I thought that was quite a good place to start, because I feel like your book Rebel Cells really helps open that door to understanding.
Thank you. And it's really interesting that you've kind of taken that out of it, because that's really what I wanted to do and what I've always done. Before I was a freelance, I worked at Cancer Research UK for 12 years, kind of talking about cancer to the public, really explaining it. And that's what I've always really wanted to do, is demystify it and tell the story about what this thing actually is. Obviously from obvious things like cancer is not just one disease, it's many, many, many diseases, maybe as unique as we are, through to like what really is it, you know, how much do we need to worry? What is going on as a cancer develops? Are we lucky? Are we unlucky? How does this stuff actually work? And even writing the book, I learned so much just about a disease that, like I say, I spent 12 years working at Cancer Research UK. I thought I knew what I was talking about. And just the adventure of learning I went on and the depth of understanding. And one of the things, not only did it give me a better understanding of really what cancer is as a biological phenomenon and what's appropriate to worry about, what's not appropriate to worry about, I really got a new way of thinking about my body and about my health and about all the things I do and the sort of the risks that I'm prepared to take and the risks I'm not prepared to take. And I find myself like looking at my skin, and now I know that, you know, I'm a woman in my 40s. I am a patchwork of mutation, like, you know, hello mutations, you know, mostly you're just doing your own thing. And my body is amazing. And really that idea that like our biology is incredible because we don't get as much cancer as we should, which seems really ironic when you're like that cancer is so incredibly common.
Yeah.
But this really deep understanding of what's going on in our bodies and how incredible our biology is. And, you know, yeah, cancer is still an incredibly scary thing. It's something that keeps me awake at night. Someone very close to me was recently diagnosed and, you know, yeah, I worry. But also understanding it almost with a sort of grudging respect for this phenomenon, this evolutionary phenomenon that it is.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that I took away from your book, was that idea that we are, if you have cells or if you have multiple cells, then you are an organism or a being that is going to be susceptible to cancer. And I really like that idea, and because you point to it that over throughout time we have always tried to find the reason for cancer, whether it was superstition or you've been mited by God that sort of thing. And I feel like, because I got breast cancer when I was 37, and so you do go through, why has this happened? And, is it my own fault? And all of these things. And I think it kind of takes away some of that when you realise that actually, if you have lots of cells, then you are susceptible to those cells mutating.
Exactly. Like, you could no more really declare war on cancer than you can declare war on multicellularity or evolution. The conclusion I came to. And the paper that I write a bit about in the book that really blew my mind and really cemented this for me, that cancer is a deep biological phenomenon that emerges out of multicellular bodies, was a paper. It came out in 2014, and it was researchers who were looking at this tiny, tiny organism called a hydra, which is basically like a little tube with tentacles on it. And these tiny things, they live in the water. And some researchers found a completely spontaneous tumor in a hydra. And you're like, this thing's only got three types of cells. This is one of the simplest organisms we can have. Mm. And it can get cancer. And then the more I talked, the more I researched. And, looking through this book that has pages and pages and pages, this list of all the species that can get cancer, from fish and birds and parakeets and badgers and baboons and absolutely everything. If you're a multicellular being, you can get cancer. Yeah. And, I have had some people, when I've talked a bit about the book, they're like, does it then matter? May as well go down the shops, buy a packet of cigarettes, just do what you like. It doesn't matter what you do. You'll get cancer. I'm like, well, there are things that we do that don't help, obviously. There are things that we do, this idea that cancer is kind of a combination of our tissue biology, our multicellular bodies, and the mutations, the genetic changes in our cells. So yeah, don't add to your mutational load if you can help it. And also don't do things that will disrupt and damage your tissue unless you can help it. So there are things we can do. But fundamentally, this view that cancer is, it's never something that you have brought upon yourself. It's never something that you can go, yep, that was your fault. If you hadn't done that, you wouldn't have got cancer, because it's such an emergent, multi-complex thing that emerges out of a complex system, and it's impossible to pin one thing on any cancer and say, yeah, it was definitely that. You just can't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought one of the places to sort of start a conversation is that I think we do ask why a lot, and I certainly spend a lot of time thinking, because cancer doesn't run in my family. There's myself, and I think on dad's side, a cousin and a great, so it was really out of the blue that I would get breast cancer. But I'm really intrigued by the point that you make, where you say we need to start asking why people don't get cancer. And I'd love you to tease that out a little bit.
Yeah, this really struck me, because as scientists, we always want to understand the disease. We want to understand why. Why did this happen? And certainly in cancer, we've only ever focused on what caused cancer. We look at cancer cells. We look at cancer samples. It's all about those rogue cells. And we study them, and we try and recapitulate the journey that they've been on to get where they've got to. And we never stop to think about why people don't get cancer, or why we are well. We tend to only focus on why we get sick. And this was really brought home to me. This was some research that was done by scientists at the Sanger Centre in Cambridge just a couple of years ago. And it's only now that we've really got the technology where we can take tiny samples of tissue, whether that's cancer tissue or normal tissue, and do DNA sequencing, genetic sequencing, and really look at a very, very fine level at what is going on in these tissues. And because it's now got cheap enough and easy enough and technically advanced enough, it now starts to become feasible that you could do this on normal cells. Yes. And they were like, no one's really done this. No one's looked for mutations, really, the extent of mutations in normal tissue, because why would you? Because, like, yeah, it's normal, right? You know, duh. And so they took, there were little slices of eyelid skin. So this is leftover from cosmetic procedures. And I took tiny, tiny little patches of this skin, did the DNA sequencing, and discovered that, like, completely normal skin is a patchwork of mutation. And, you know, by the time you get to, like, middle age, you are a patchwork of mutation. And not only that, like, the mutations that they found, if you'd found them in a cancer, you would say that that mutation is, like, a cancer gene, a cancer mutation. Yeah. And you're like, this is just what normal life is like. Like, all your cells have seen some stuff, right? You know, they're all messed up. And we find this everywhere we look. Like, you find this in the esophagus. That was the next study they did. You find it in the endometrium, the lining of the womb, in the blood. We are just patchworks of mutation. And again, as a woman sort of heading into my 40s, I'm like, yeah, you know, feeling it.
Yeah.
That was really... That absolutely blew my mind, because if you think that normal healthy tissue, so nothing cancerous about it, this is just normal life, it's just full of a mess of mutations and all this kind of stuff. But cancer is incredibly rare on a personal level. Mm. And I just want to unpack that, because people hear me say, like, cancer is rare, and they're like, bloody isn't. Like, it's incredibly common. One in two people will get cancer. How can you say it's rare? But on an absolute personal level, you are made of trillions and trillions of cells that multiply billions of times in your lifetime. Yet each one of us may get one, maybe two cancers in our entire lifetime out of all those trillions of messed up cells.
Yeah.
So the real question is, like, why does this not happen more often? And also, something really wild must be happening for those cells to actually make the leap out and become a cancer cell and become a cancer. So that, I think, is really interesting. And that's where you start to understand it as a disease of multicellularity, as a disease of tissue, of these sort of all these rogue cells. At some point, there is a tipping point where cells can finally go rogue and become a cancer, but we don't really understand it on that tissue level yet. And I think that's the really interesting frontier.
And I think that's the hard part for people, of not understanding why they went rogue. You know, what causes those cells to, you know, decide to go rogue and overpopulate. And I think that's a really difficult thing to kind of sit with and at the moment and say, we don't know, it just happened. That's not what we're used to being okay with.
It's really hard, because the other thing as well is something that made me think a lot while I was writing the book, is not just about, like, what is cancer, because we can define cancer medically, but, like, when is cancer? When on this spectrum from, like, you know, slightly mutated dodgy cells through to, like, frank metastatic disease, like, what, when is a cancer a cancer? Because right now, you know, you, me, every single person listening to this has probably, like, tiny little proto tumors, rogue cells doing their thing. They will never develop into a cancer. I like, why? And you know, that this is one of the things when people say, oh, you know, maybe we should all have an MRI scan every couple of years just to see what's in there. It's like, hell no. you do not want to see what's in there. If we started looking for every little patch of dodgy looking cells, every lump and bump, like, it would drive you crazy, and it wouldn't be a good idea at all. So this sort of journey of, like, when is a cancer a cancer? What is actually the trigger that finally sends it over the edge? Can we find ways of, you know, dialing it back, preventing it, even just pushing that journey out, you know, 5, 10, 15 years in our lifetimes? That would really start to make a difference, because cancer really generally is a disease of old age. And yeah. I go into the book in some detail about, like, you know, basically that's evolution, like, screwing with us. We've evolved kind of to get to our 60s and not much further, which is very, very sad. Yeah. But if we can kind of beat that a bit, if we can push out the onset of cancer by a decade, maybe more, then that starts to become really transformative. So really understanding what is actually going on, what's happening in healthy tissue, how can we, like, keep our tissues buff, is some really interesting stuff, I think.
Do you have any insight into why some ethnicities seemingly get higher rates of certain cancers?
Yeah, that is an interesting one. I didn't really dig into it in a lot of detail in the book. I mean, there's definitely some cases we know about, things like, I think it's African-American men are at much higher risk of prostate cancer and black men generally. So there will be some aspect of genetic diversity. There's also going to be sort of all other kinds of factors that play into this, like some of which we can unpick, some of which are going to be very difficult to unpick. But yeah, I'd say that isn't a particular area that I'm really can talk a lot to, because I didn't really go into it in the book.
Yeah, it's all right. I just sort of, because in New Zealand we, and this is actually, I put it out to listeners and people across social media, what do you want to know? And I think, especially in New Zealand, we feel we have quite high rates of cancer, especially breast cancer, prostate, bowel, and skin cancers are quite prevalent here. And I think people sort of have this perception that, you know, we're getting them younger. Why is this happening? Is it our diet? Is it, you know, what's going on? And so I was quite intrigued by that, because I guess one of my takeaways was just what you were talking about, is that it is a disease of older age, of, you know, of 60 plus. And I know for myself, I was still quite a rarity, really, to have got cancer, you know, in my 30s. And so I am kind of intrigued of, are our cancer rates quite high, or is it a perception that they're high?
I don't know your stats. I'm not prepared to comment. I think there's some things that we do know about cancer risk. So yeah, having said all the stuff about fundamentally this is a disease of biology, you know, we do know that there are things that increase the risk of cancer. There are things that we don't yet know about that probably increase the risk of cancer, and there are some interesting projects trying to find that out. You know, generally we know that doing all the boring stuff like healthy diet, don't smoke, don't drink too much, or, you know, be careful in the sun, all that stuff will reduce the risk. Some of the things we don't actually understand why, like we don't really know why physical activity, taking exercise, is so protective against many types of cancer. And I think it's going to come down to things like tissue and like reducing inflammation in your body and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot we don't understand about things like inflammation, which is a trigger. It sort of disrupts the tissue and I think can allow cancer cells to emerge. So I think that is a real area, like, are there things in our lives that are increasing inflammation? Can we understand that? Can we tackle that? And then also you do have the questions about the genetic diversity of the human genome. And we know, of course, there are genetic variations that have big impacts on cancer risk, you know, things like the BRCA genes that increase the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And then we have all the subtle variations that sort of slightly increase or slightly decrease our risk of all different types of cancers. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to unpick. One of the challenging things in terms of the ethnicity in particular is that so many of our cancer databases and our genetic databases are from people with white European ancestry. Mm. We just do not have enough diversity in our genomic databases, in our knowledge, to start to really unpick those questions. And I think, yeah, as again, DNA sequencing's got cheaper and it's getting faster and more work is being done to massively expand diversity and bring more people into these kind of projects. I think we will start to know more.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think our rates, and I've had a look at them, are kind of similar to the UK. So it's the big sort of breast, bowel, prostate for me, and those sorts of things. So perhaps it's our British ancestry that has
Might be. You know.
Or the ozone layer. The sun in New Zealand is very, very strong. I don't spend a lot of time in the sun during the summer with my pale skin.
No, me neither. I live in the UK and I don't spend any time in the sun. I just burn in a millisecond. So this is one reason why I'm afraid I'm never going to make it over to your part of the world, because like it's just too hot. Too hot for me.
And I guess this kind of takes us to that idea that cancer isn't a modern disease. And I really enjoy this idea, because I think we are so quick to sort of say people X amount of years ago lived so much better. And it's like, no, they died at 30 from infections.
Yeah, that was a big myth that I wanted to bust. Like, and if you take nothing away from the book, take away the thing that like cancer is not a modern disease and it's not just a human disease. Like this goes deep, 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 deep back into evolutionary time. You know, the fact that we find cancer across all species, across the tree of life, like this is a disease with deep biological evolutionary roots. And then in terms of human populations, we find examples of cancer wherever we find humans. So there are fossils, there are human remains that are tens of thousands of years old with evidence of tumours. What we don't know is how prevalent it was, because unfortunately, when you find human remains, you don't get beautifully epidemiologically matched, age-matched series. You get what you get. Very annoying. And you know, and yes, there were many more things in the past that could kill you quite dramatically in many cases. You know, women dying in childbirth, children dying of infectious diseases before they'd even turned five, people dying of violence, all sorts of things trying to kill you, basically. So we do live longer, and we certainly do live now. You know, we are in the first time in our lives that humans have lived this long. In the evolution of our species, humans have never lived this long. Mm. So, yeah. That's why we're seeing rates of cancer going up. I think there probably are other things underneath it. You know, there will be other factors that are driving some types of cancer rates. But it's a deep, deep disease that has always been with us. And I think that, you know, some people say, well, because you don't find many cancers in ancient remains, it must have been incredibly rare. It's like, well, A, you just don't know. Because, you know, lots of people died of a lot of other things. And also, I think the fact that you can find examples of things like very rare childhood cancers suggests that, like, you know, it was there. It has always been with us. So, yeah it's an ancient disease.
Yes, absolutely. And it this struck me as well, I guess, you know, as I read through your book, and the idea that we are quite good at treating early cancers. You know, we can cut it out and we know that that's gone. Thank you very much. It's when it spreads that it becomes more complicated. And I'm quite intrigued by this, of why is it so complicated to treat once it spreads?
Well, we can blame Charles Darwin for this one. Because this is where cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon really comes into play. And, you know, it's been fascinating. I've wanted to write this book for actually quite a long time. And what really triggered me wanting to write it was starting to appreciate cancer, and particularly advanced cancer, as such an evolutionary phenomenon. Because this is what makes advanced cancers really difficult to treat. Mm. Because it's not, all the cells are not the same. So once cells are multiplying, they start to diversify. They can pick up new changes, new mutations. There are selective pressures that are acting upon them. And it's just like any species. You know, you have genetic diversity in a species. You have selective pressures, you know, predation, food, landscape, environment, all these kind of things. And the fittest will thrive and the weaker ones will die, and the fittest will thrive and pass on their genes. So effectively, cancer cells are doing this survival of the fittest thing. And this is where stuff gets really difficult, because particularly for advanced cancers, you know, we have made a lot of progress in treating cancer, but particularly for those advanced cancers, there are some amazing success stories of people being treated, sometimes often with, you know, very fancy, expensive targeted therapies. And they seem to work amazingly for months, maybe a year or two. And then the cancer comes back. And that treatment will no longer work because the cancer has evolved resistance to it. So you either have to try another treatment or you're out of options.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, someone who I interviewed for the book, a chap called Crispian, and he has stage 4 metastatic kidney cancer. And he's sort of been playing this cycle of different drugs. I think he's now onto at least his third cycle of treatment. He's now, I think, over 4 years since his diagnosis, which is really incredible. But it's what I kind of call whack-a-mole. So you have a treatment and you keep going with it, but at some point you know that your cancer is going to evolve resistance and you have to just really hope that there's another option to try. And this is the fundamental problem with treating advanced cancers. And I don't think that we've really addressed it head on. There are researchers and doctors are really starting to think about it. Drug companies don't particularly want to think about it because it means that your wonderful, fancy, very expensive drug will only ever work for a limited amount of time. And you have to think about strategies for overcoming that resistance. So, you know, there's some quite challenging sections in the book where I sort of throw the gauntlet down to companies to come up with just do better, basically. Yeah. Come up with strategies to get over this resistance, and also talking to researchers who are using incredible combinations of maths and evolutionary biology to come up with better strategies that really take this evolutionary process into account and kind of try and steer the evolution of cancers where we want them to go, or even drive them to extinction altogether. Mm. And I think that stuff is hugely exciting.
Absolutely, because I had HER2-positive breast cancer, and what I found quite interesting about it is that for me, the chemotherapy was kind of add on top, but it was the Herceptin, and I had a newish drug, pertuzumab, and those two were the ones that were actually going to be doing, you know, a good job. Because I know that before Herceptin, my chances would have been about 50-50. They would have given me chemotherapy, you know, fingers crossed it, you know, does the work. And I remember a woman I used to work with who was in pharmacology, and she was at the conference where I think the results of Herceptin, when it, you know, the clinical trials were announced. And she said people were just amazed and they were so hopeful because finally there was something that, you know, might be able to help people like me with, you know, an aggressive cancer. And so I find those immunotherapies really interesting in the way that they're, you know, they are the advances that we have probably hoped for.
There have been incredible advances, and I don't sort of want to just slag off the whole pharmaceutical industry because they are the way that we turn science into treatments, and there have been some really phenomenal successes. You know, the poster child for this is a drug called Gleevec, which is for a type of leukemia, and it's absolutely transformed that disease. And it's a drug that was designed to specifically lock in to the faulty molecule that drives those cancer cells that's caused by a very specific genetic change. And things like the drug that you took, Herceptin, again, it's designed to specifically lock in to the faulty molecule that is driving your cancer cells.
Yeah.
The problem comes when there is enough diversity in the cancer that there are too many cells that don't have that change or have found some way to be resistant to the drug. Because the drug will then get rid of all the cells that are sensitive to that drug, and it will leave the ones that are resistant. Mm. And then you can start to get clever with certain combinations and timing and all this kind of thing and hope to get rid of all the cancer cells. But again, this is why it's really important to diagnose cancer as early as possible, treat it as early as possible, because you don't want it to be getting to that stage where it has become like this sort of evolutionary monster.
Yeah.
But certainly I think that the paradigm that we're moving towards, where you're just thinking about let's find the faulty molecule, target the faulty molecule, and that's going to cure cancer, it's just not going to work, because there's going to be cancers where somewhere in there there are cells that are resistant to whatever therapy you choose to throw at them. Mm. And so we need to have clever strategies, even with the drugs that we already have. I think there are much cleverer ways of using many of the treatments we have, or even drugs that have been shelved for not being, you know, good enough or targeted enough, that may actually work in a more evolutionarily informed way. So I think there's, it's really exciting because there's so much knowledge and so much potential. And now we have the tools, we have the computation, we have the sort of mathematical models and all this kind of stuff, to, and the genetic knowledge to start really drilling into this. It's, I feel like this is such an exciting time.
It is. And I'm sure I wrote it down because I like this idea of maybe thinking about we must cure cancer. It needs to be kind of packaged or rethought. And I'd love you to talk a little bit about that.
I think in the book I describe it as like the narrative of the cure. We've sort of been seduced by this narrative. You know, I used to work for a cancer charity, and that's the thing that drives us all. It's finding the cure for cancer.
Yes.
Yeah, the Cancer Research UK was first founded in 1903, and all these charities are founded to find the cure. And yeah, we joke about it. It's become such a part of popular culture. Yeah, finding the cure for cancer. Mm. And the cure for cancer may not look like we thought. This idea that the cure for cancer is a bottle of particular pills and it will cure all cancers. And because all cancers are different for a start. So that makes things complicated. And then also that there may be some cancers that a cure, we're really talking about an extinction event. We're talking about a very carefully calculated series of different treatments, different timings that are designed to completely collapse this population of cells. And that's going to be complicated to do because it's going to involve measuring and monitoring and understanding the genetic diversity that's in there and the resistance mechanisms that are evolving and emerging. It's not just going to be a bottle of pills. Mm. And then for other cases, it may be if you can't drive to extinction, but you can turn it into this chronic, ongoing, controlled disease for many, many years. And there's some very exciting work going on at the Moffitt Cancer Center down in Tampa in Florida, trying these approaches that kind of turn cancers, that in prostate cancer in particular, into this sort of long-term disease. Mm. And that's not a cure. People are still going to be living with cancer, but they will be living much longer and with a better quality of life and with a controlled disease rather than trying to eradicate it, nuke it from orbit. But again, that's not the cure. So you've got to kind of get your head around it.
Yeah.
And but as a fundraiser, like, how do you sell that? How do you sell the idea that the cure might be like, well, you're just going to live with it for like 20 years.
Mm.
Give us your money.
probably not the easiest.
Yeah. I mean, also, this is the thing as well with the sort of the narrative that we have. And I get to this really at the end of the book, and this is where it turns philosophical, is, yeah, everyone, we all have to die of something.
Mm.
And, like, what is the end game? We do all die. Everyone dies in the end. And, you know, I'd obviously rather that it was at a very, very healthy old age and obviously not of cancer or, you know, potentially through some terrible sexual misadventure. That would be quite fun. But, you know, what is the end game? I went to talk to Peter Campbell, who's one of the world's leading cancer geneticists. And I said, what is the end game? He was like, well, I guess it's that you live long enough to die of something else. Like, I'll take that. You know, I think cancer is a horrific way to die. It's just awful. And I certainly would love to see no one being taken with cancer in the prime of life. And now, you know, people living through their 60s, 70s, 80s in healthy life. Mm. That should be our goal. Ultimately a world entirely free of cancer is not going to happen because cancer emerges out of multicellular bodies. We will never live in a world, I think, where it will never happen.
Mm.
But we really are starting to get up to a point where we can really choose what we do about it. And like I say, I do think that is incredibly exciting.
Yeah. And I mean, I found that reassuring. I it helped me kind of make sense of it, you know, and take away the kind of the blame and the that sort of stuff. I was quite keen to talk to you about this because there is a sea of misinformation out there about cancer and about diets and superfoods and special regimes that people, you know, go to Mexico to get and have, you know, colonics every day. You know, there's all of this sort of, I kind of see it as like the snake oil industry that runs alongside cancer. And once you've been diagnosed with it, you're kind of exposed to all of it. And so I was quite curious about your point of view about the alternative cancer treatments. I mean, is there a place for it, or is it sort of running in the wrong direction?
So I struggle with this a lot. When I was at Cancer Research UK, I was kind of the in-house alternative medicine expert, and I made it my job to find out about all these therapies, to find out what they were, was there an evidence base for them. I looked at some very weird papers, you know, I would look at the websites. Yes. I was reading the comments on the Daily Mail articles to see what people are thinking, what people were saying, you know, all the conspiracies. That was my beat. And trying to get to the bottom of it and trying to understand, you know, what actually is this treatment? Is there any evidence for it? And so many times it would just be like, no, there just isn't. And it's very hard to tell people because the standards by which we judge medical science are not the same as the standards by which alternative therapies say that they judge themselves. Mm. You know, an anecdote on a website is not the same as a clinical trial, but they seem almost equally persuasive to a lot of people, particularly if you are really, really wanting an answer. And, you know, clinical trials, very dry data, and often they're not, you know, they're not a yes, we can cure you. They're a, well, you have a something, something 0.3% chance or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a positive story. And it's about the story that this sort of industry tells you,
yes,
for a start, about what causes cancer, and then about, there's a lot, I think, of personal blame in there, and this sort of idea that it's to do with the toxicity of the world or the toxicity of your life or all these kind of things, and that if only you could purify and cleanse yourself enough,
yes,
you would get rid of this. And it's like, that doesn't work biologically, and it's a really harmful and dangerous narrative. And it's difficult because it's a very seductive narrative, because people want to do something. They want to do something they feel in control of. They maybe want to do something that they feel gives them hope, when perhaps medical science has said there's not much more we can do. Yeah. But I think it's an incredibly, for want of a better word, toxic narrative, because it's incredibly misleading. It can lead people to, you know, spend time that they don't have pursuing therapies that will never work, have no evidence of working, often come with huge cost financially, personally, socially, in terms of their family and their quality of life, you know. And I would never say, oh, you know, I think all of this stuff should be banned, because that just drives it underground, because people have a hunger for this. So I think the solution is, again, better education of explaining to people what we can, what we can't do, and even explaining and understanding from our own side what people are actually looking for, and telling a better story that engages people in this disease and what's happening to them.
Because I have a theory about it, because during chemo, I spent a lot of time in bed. Chemotherapy for me just, It floored me. And also because of, you know, the steroids and things, I had a lot of insomnia. So I went down a lot of YouTube rabbit holes.
Oh, God.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head, is that inherently humans need control. And we have this sort of underlying thing where the medical industry is to be mistrusted, and the pharmaceutical industry is a, you know, there's all of that going on. And so when you're told, we don't actually have control over your body, there's something that's going on, we may not be, you know, all of those things, that's very, very hard for us to cope with. And then the other side of it is that I think there is this idea of purity and about cleansing yourself and ridding yourself of these things. When the simple answer is that, well, we do have a detoxifying system in our bodies. It's called the kidneys. But people, you are so vulnerable when you have cancer that you want to grab onto anything that you think might help you. And I know, for instance, with my oncologist, he was fantastic because I could ask him lots of questions and he was very, you know, straight up. And he basically said to me, just eat a sensible diet and exercise. And for a lot of people, that's like, that's not enough.
Yeah. Like, you got to do all this. Yeah, goji berries five times a day. I find it challenging. I used to talk a lot to the head of the nursing team at Cancer Research UK. We had a team of information nurses who are absolutely incredible people. And the guy, Martin Ledwick, who ran the team, because I used to be a lot more kind of hardline about this stuff. And I was like, it's just stupid and it's terrible. We should tell people never to do any of this stuff. And he was like, just A, get some empathy. I was quite young. And B, it's like, if someone wants to wear a caftan and wave some crystals around because it makes them feel better, who am I to tell them that they shouldn't,
Yeah.
And I think it's really understanding what people are looking for. It's a scary time. We need comfort. We need control. We need to feel that we're doing something positive. We want hope, particularly when it feels that there is no hope. I think generally I've become a lot less hardline about things that don't have the capacity to be harmful.
Mm.
Where I'm much more concerned about is where people are being told to not take treatments, to not take pain relief, incredibly restrictive diets, some terrible purging regimes, all sorts of things where there is the real capacity for harm.
Yes.
And also, where people are going off to pursue treatments where there is absolutely no evidence that they work at high cost at the end of life, I think is where things start to get really, really difficult.
Absolutely.
It's understanding what people are looking for and how do we tell them the story about what is actually based in reality that will resonate and answer those questions and the needs that people have.
Absolutely. And I have a few questions from listeners. I said, we've got a geneticist coming on. What do you want to know?
Oh, God. I'm not really a geneticist.
One was, why is cancer such a mother beep? I thought, well, it is. But one of them is that if I got cancer, does it mean my children will? So are you at greater risk of it if one of your parents has had cancer?
The answer to that is it really depends. It really, really, really depends on the type of cancer. So we know that there are some genetic variations that run in families that do increase the risk of cancer. So we have things like the BRCA genes that increase the risk of ovarian, prostate cancer and some other types of cancer. There are genes that significantly increase the risk of bowel cancers. There are various other syndromes. So we know that there are some strong hereditary genetic variations. So if you have one of those genetic variations and you have cancer and your child has inherited that genetic variation, they will have an elevated risk of the same types of cancer. More generally, there are going to be more subtle genetic variations that increase and decrease the risk. We don't know loads about all of those. And it's going to be this whole hurly-burly combination of all the genetic variations that you have that adds up to your personal cancer risk. And your children will have half from you and then half from, whoever the other half of your children comes from, which will kind of add up to their own unique mix. So, it's a bit of those like, well, which cancer and how? And, let me do a quick genetic test on you first before I can really answer that question.
Yeah. Actually, I find that interesting because I know that there is testing that can tell you the effectiveness of treatment. I think in New Zealand, I think you have to pay for it. But I know in other countries, they're starting to do it. Like in terms of chemotherapy, they can test you and tell you, you know, will this be effective? And I wish I'd known about that because I would have loved to know it before I went through it. But do you think that's the future, is to be able to test more and really actually look at the genetic side of it? Will that tell us more, do you think?
Absolutely. And I just actually did an episode of my own podcast, Genetics Unzipped, which was looking all into the future of cancer from this genetic testing genomic level, because there's two separate sides to the genetics of cancer. So there's one about your personal genetic makeup that influences your risk of cancer. And then the second aspect of the genetics is the genetics of the tumour itself, the disease itself. And it's gone on its kind of choose your own adventure evolutionary journey. So it will have started from your own cells, your own genetic makeup, but we'll have picked up all kinds of genetic changes and mutations on the journey to becoming a cancer. And then as it's evolving and evolving resistance to treatment and changing within the body as it develops. So this idea that you can tailor treatment, it's called precision medicine, kind of approach, where you can test a sample of someone's cancer, look for certain genetic changes, and that will help to guide therapy. That is definitely the way that treatment is going. I think it is, I think it can be very useful. I think you have to be very careful. Are you actually capturing all the genetic diversity in the tumor? Mm. And often if you just take a sample, squish it all up and sequence it, you're going to miss maybe the tiny pockets of cells that might be resistant to therapy.
Wow.
So it's not just kind of a one and done, you know, oh, we sequenced your tumor and it was like this. It's like, well, it's going to be helpful. And absolutely, I think it's going to be helpful. I don't think that, well, without bringing it more into a better understanding of the actual process of how things are evolving and changing and how that person responds to treatment, how their disease responds to treatment, and then deciding what you do next, you know, which again is more tricky than like, we just sequence your tumor, we give you this combination of drugs and that should work. Oh, it didn't. Bad luck.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be the absolute, you know, kind of moonshot one and done and dusted thing that I think we might hope for, but I think it's certainly a very useful tool.
And with a genetic mutation, that must be the hard part to figure out why a gene mutates. Is that right? Or do we know?
This is super interesting, right? So I love like the whole science of mutations and how does our DNA get damaged? Because really, you know, cancer is a combination of genetic changes, mutations that happen in the DNA, the genetic code inside our cells that tells our cells what to do.
Yeah.
It's a combination of the cells being mutated, the DNA and the cells being mutated, and then also the tissue environment that lets mutated cells get away with it. So what actually causes mutations? Well, I mean, the bad news, and I hate to share this with your listeners, the bad news is that being alive really is bad for your DNA. Just being alive will give you loads of mutations in your DNA because just the biological processes of life damage your DNA.
Yeah.
You know, every time you make new cells, you have to copy all your DNA. And you put mistakes in it. Like DNA replication is not perfect. There are biochemical processes at work in our cells that create little molecules so that damage our DNA. There are also things coming from outside the body. So, you know, in the foods that we eat, the things we expose ourselves to, obvious ones, my favorite examples are things like ultraviolet light from the sun, which causes a very specific type of DNA damage. It causes two letters of DNA to fuse together. And also, obviously, cigarette smoke. We can spot the damage that cigarette smoke does. It's got a really characteristic signature.
Wow.
And one project that I talk about in the book, and it's a project I've actually worked on separately as a writer, is called The Mutagraphs of Cancer.
Wow.
And it's being led by researchers at the Sanger Institute in Cambridge, but it's a massive international project. It's funded by Cancer Research UK. It's a huge project. And they're looking at thousands of samples of cancer from five continents and using very, very detailed genetic sequencing to look for these fingerprints of damage from different processes and from different chemicals. And then you can go, all right, what actually does cause DNA damage? is it stuff in the environment, in this country, in this area, for this type of cancer? Can we then reduce people's exposure to it? So I got to go to the Czech Republic, where they have really high rates of bladder cancer, particularly kidney cancers and pancreatic cancers. So they're trying to find out, well, why is that? And then also we got to go to Kenya, which was, again, super cool. But they have very high rates of esophageal cancer, certain type. So they're looking for, can we study these tumours and find out what it might be, in whether it's in people's lifestyles, in people's environments, or in people's underlying genetics, that is increasing the risk of these cancers, and looking for these kind of the fingerprints of the culprits.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what really became clear to me writing the book is, again, you can never pin the blame on just one culprit.
No.
So the analogy I use is the Murder on the Orient Express, the Agatha Christie film. And spoilers, I'm going to give some serious spoilers here, so close your ears. Basically, everyone done it, right? Everyone has a go at the murder, so you can't tell who actually did it. And it's the same thing with cancer. We find so much damage. A typical cancer has tens of thousands of mutations in it. You can't say, oh, it was that thing, and on that day when you smoked that cigarette, that was what did it. Because it's the combination of many, many, many thousands of mutations and the tissue biology and, you know, a dose of bad luck. Yeah. I think is in there too. You know, call it kismet, call it fate, whatever you call it. Something, it emerges out of your tissue, and you can never say, yes, it was exactly this thing that did it. You probably point the finger and say, well, there are some things that probably didn't help. Mm. But you can never entirely pin, 100% pin the blame on any one thing.
It's so, and it's so fascinating, isn't it?
I know, right? That's why I wrote a book about it.
Yeah, I know. It's so interesting the way our genetics, you know, appear. And because I've been looking into especially genetic things in my family, and I find it so fascinating that I have a cousin in the UK who is dad's half brother's son. And so you'd think, oh, that's not, you know, that's diluted, but we are so similar. It is hilarious.
Yeah.
Even strange mannerisms and things. I'm like, I do that too. And it's just, it's really, really interesting the way that that's kind of come down the line.
Yeah, I do. I find genetics just endlessly fascinating. I mean, that's really why I wrote my first book, Herding Hemingway's Cats, was just like, how do genes work? Like, how do you go from this strand of DNA that's in a cell, like a fertilized egg is just one cell with a set of DNA, and you unfold life out of that?
Mm.
And it just, you know, that's what I wanted to do my PhD in. It just blew my mind. It's always driven me as a scientist. And then really this book, it's kind of the flip side of that, because it's how do you go from a cell, a normal cell, and unfold something absolutely terrible out of it? Mm. And when I did my PhD, I did it in an institute that was, it had developmental biology on one floor and cancer biology on the floor below. And we used to talk all the time because our work was almost like the mirror image. And cancer is really, it is about life. The whole book is a book about life, but life gone terribly, terribly wrong.
Yes.
And that question about how do you unfold something from one cell, from one genome into all the diversity, and whether that's all the diversity of life on Earth, whether it's the incredible body of a baby growing in the womb, or the horrendous process of a cancer developing, you know, that is what I find endlessly fascinating.
It is. It is utterly fascinating. Your book is utterly fascinating. Where can listeners purchase it? Stop listening and go onto the internet to order.
Immediately go to the internet. So you can go to, well, I have a little website for the book, which I still need to update with all the new fun things that I've been doing. It's rebelcellbook.com, but it should be available from all good bookshops. So, you know, all good and evil retailers in your country of choice, you should be able to find it. Online. It's called Rebel Cell, Cancer Evolution and the Science of Life by me, Kat Arney, A-R-N-E-Y. And also, if you like the kind of stuff that I talk about, if you like genetics and all that kind of thing, I have a podcast called Genetics Unzipped that covers, you know, stories from the history of genetics, particularly women scientists. I find that being overlooked. I love telling their stories. And we also have interviews with like the very latest cutting edge researchers. So you can go and check that out. It's just geneticsunzip.com.
That's great. I'll check a link up as well so people can find it. But thank you so much for your time. It's been so interesting. And I found it really, I really enjoyed reading it because for me, it kind of took away some of that fear. And I know, I don't know if it sounds defeatist or negative, but it was kind of like, you know what, sometimes things happen and actually you just need to get on and live life. You're right, it's about living and getting, you know, enjoying what you have because we are so complex and there's so little we know at the moment that getting stuck in, you know, why did this happen to me? You know, isn't necessarily beneficial.
Life is amazing. It's just, it gives me such an incredible respect for like, for my own body. I have started taking a bit more care of myself since I started writing the book. But yeah, it's really good to know actually how it lands with people who've had cancer, because that was really my worry, was that people would, it's always very hard with people going through cancer. Like, what do they want to know? They want to read about it, but they don't want to read about it. But yeah, it's really good to hear that it kind of landed well. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining me today. The C Word airs every Sunday on Auckland's Planet FM 104.6 FM or online at www.planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next time.